going to read now from the Old Testament, Isaiah chapter 52. It's page 779 in your pew Bibles. And I'm going to read the first 10 verses. See if you can pick out the verse that is quoted in the New Testament in the book of Romans as I read. Isaiah 52, verses 1 to 10. Awake, awake, put on your strength, O Zion. Put on your beautiful garments, O Jerusalem, the holy city. For there shall no more come into you the uncircumcised and the unclean. Shake yourself from the dust and arise. Be seated, O Jerusalem. Loose the bonds from your neck, O captive daughter of Zion. For thus says the Lord, you were sold for nothing, and you shall be redeemed without money. For thus says the Lord God, my people went down at the first into Egypt to sojourn there, and the Assyrian oppressed them for nothing. Now therefore, what have I here, declares the Lord, seeing that my people are taken away for nothing? Their rulers wail, declares the Lord, and continually all the day my name is despised. Therefore my people shall know my name. Therefore in that day they shall know that it is I who speak. Here I am. How beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of him who brings good news, who publishes peace, who brings good news of happiness, who publishes salvation, who says to Zion, your God reigns. The voice of your watchmen, they lift up their voice, together they sing for joy, for eye to eye they see the return of the Lord to Zion. Break forth together into singing, you waste places of Jerusalem, for the Lord has comforted his people, he has redeemed Jerusalem. The Lord has bared his holy arm before the eyes of all the nations, and all the ends of the earth shall see the salvation of our God. I was asked to preach on the ninth verse of Matthew chapter 5. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. And I realized that in all the years of preaching, I've never preached through Matthew chapter 5. And so this got me thinking about the Beatitudes, and I thought, you know, I should write my own version. Blessed are the happily married, for they shall be envied. Blessed are parents of accomplished children, they shall be proud. Blessed are those who dwell in large houses, for they shall be comfortable. Blessed are all who define their own meaning of life, for they live the meaning of freedom. Blessed are you when all speak well of you, for great is your reward in America. Rejoice and be exceeding glad, for you have succeeded in reflecting the spirit of the age. Blessed are the rich, for theirs is the American dream, and the European dream, and the Asian dream, and the ancient Israelite dream. And it's a picture of Job before he was bereft of everything. Think about Job. He was married. I'm not sure how happily, given the little portrait of his wife that we have in chapter 2. He had a number of children. They all got along well with each other. They went from house to house. He had riches. He had the respect of everybody who knew him. He was an honorable and honored man. Surely he was most blessed. And as Satan said to God, no wonder he worships you. You've put a fence around him and everything goes right in his life. He always lands on his feet and trouble does not come to Job. And I thought, what an interesting series of sermons on Matthew 5 would be to take Job as our example of the blessed man, and then to follow him through all that happened to him. Was he blessed when he mourned? Was he blessed when he lost everything? Was he blessed when he became poor? Was he blessed when he became the source and the object of mockery of those who had once respected him? And then what does it mean that at the end it was all restored to him? And how much more he understood the blessings that he had when he had received them through mourning and poverty and mockery. Maybe I'll do that series someday. Or maybe you can think about it yourself. You know, there's a difficulty which you may have picked up if you look at different translations, and different preachers have referred to it here. There's a real difficulty in translating the word in Greek that is translated here, blessed. The alternate translation is happy. Neither one is satisfactory. So I want to talk for a moment about the meaning of the Greek word translated either blessed or happy. First of all, put away the suspicion that modern translators have taken this really powerful word blessed and substituted the word happy and dumbed it down. I looked up Matthew Henry. Matthew Henry is a late Puritan commentator, late 1600s. Matthew Henry just totally disregards the word blessed and uses the word happy all the way through his commentary on Matthew chapter 5. Here's the difficulty. There is a very well-known and used Greek word which definitely means blessed. I'm going to use the modern Greek translation pronunciation, so all you seminary-educated people, it's not my fault you didn't learn the correct way of pronouncing these things. So here is the word translated blessed. It's evlogimenos. The word in Matthew is makarios. You'll notice they're not even closely related. There's also a perfectly good word for happy in Greek. It's ευτυχής. You'll notice ευτυχής is nowhere close to makarios. So our translators are stuck. They've got two words that sort of get at makarios, but neither one is the standard Greek word for blessed or happy. Makarios carries with it something of the meaning of a relatively recent English word. It has at its root the idea of full or complete. The English word would be fulfilled. So you might take Jesus' first beatitude and say, fulfilled in their lives, or they've lived a complete life, are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Fulfilled, they've lived a complete and full life, are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. You know, sometimes we talk about somebody who comes to death and we say they have lived a full and complete life. That's not uncommon to say in our circles. And that seems to be as much as anything as I can figure out what Jesus is saying here. Here's what it takes to live a full and complete life. You have fulfilled what life is all about. If you've mourned, if you've been poor in spirit, if you are meek, if you've hungered and thirsted for righteousness, if you've learned how to be merciful, if you're pure in heart, if you're a peacemaker. It's very tempting, for Christians, I would say especially Christians in the Puritan tradition, to stop with verse 9. Because all the way through verse 9, although verse 9 is kind of a hinge in the Beatitudes, all the way through verse 9, you can take these as sort of interior spiritual things. You can mourn quietly and other people don't know. We think of poor in spirit. Now, Luke leaves off the in spirit, by the way, when he accounts this. But you can leave off and say that's, you know, it's your interior spiritual struggle. But you know, when you get to verse 10, this is public social stuff. Your life is full. It's complete when you are persecuted for righteousness' sake. Your life is full and complete when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil things against you falsely on account of your being followers of Jesus Christ. And you notice when you get to those verses, you can't say this is a kind of a spiritual issue or an internal issue only. I mean, this is public and nasty stuff. So these Beatitudes, if we stop with verse 9, we miss the public and social aspect of these sayings of Jesus that are so contrary to how we live and think. Now, as I said, I think verse 9 is sort of a hinge. Blessed are the peacemakers. You know, we usually think of peacemakers as, that's not just going on inside our own souls or inside our own minds. That involves us with other people. So this morning, what I want to do is talk about who are peacemakers, what does it mean to call them sons of God, and then a few concluding comments. So when I started thinking about this passage, I thought, okay, so who are peacemakers? And my first thought went to Philippians chapter 4, verses 2 and 3, where Paul writes to the elders and the overseers in the church of Philippi, along with the entire church, and he says, Euodia and Syntyche, would you please get along with each other? And how'd you like to be called out for all time in a letter in the Bible, right? That's all we really know about those two. Except that he goes on and he says, yes, and he's speaking to the elders and the deacons, yes, would you help those two women who have been such service of the kingdom of God to make peace with each other? That's an awful lot of the work of elders. Did you know that? I just read a history of the Reformed churches in France. This is kind of like a summary history, just recently been published. It works on all kinds of little monographs that have been written in the last 50 years, known as Huguenots, if you can't speak French, and a better pronunciation if you can. Examination of their session minutes shows that the majority of the time of those sessions was taken up in getting two tradesmen who were quarreling in the church to make peace, or two peasants who were arguing about the boundaries between their property to make peace, and on and on and on. Anybody who's worked on a session knows that sometimes an awful lot of time is spent trying to get husband and wife to make peace, or sometimes parents and children to make peace. Church fights can be nasty when you get different factions. Sometimes they simply split churches. In fact, I think I remember the history that this church has its origin a long time ago in a church quarrel. Long time ago. You can ask the old people in this church who were historians to tell you if you're interested. I don't think it's edifying. Church fights are nasty and they are a bad witness to the world. Paul writes a whole letter to the church in Corinth in which a large part of the letter is saying, you got this faction that says it's a Pauline faction, and this faction that says it's a Petrine faction, and this faction that says it follows Apollos, and this faction is, well, we follow Christ. And then you had people taking each other to court. I want to ask for a show of hands of how many of you have taken somebody else in here to court recently. Paul says don't do it. So that's the first thing. Counseling is become extremely popular in the training of pastors in the last 20, 30 years. Now, what's counseling about? Well, an awful lot of counseling is just peacemaking. Now, there are other pieces to it, but an awful lot of it is just peacemaking. All right, you counsel husbands and wives. I mentioned this before. One of my favorite things to do as a pastor was to meet with a future husband and wife before they got married, pre-marriage counseling. My least favorite thing to do as a pastor was post-marriage counseling. But that's peacemaking. I told you I had five ideas, or maybe I didn't. I had five ideas about who's a peacemaker. And this is the first one. Here's the second one. I had a girl come into my homeroom about 5 years before I retired. She came up to me and she said, "Hi, my brother told me I had to say hello to you and meet you before I graduated. So I'm a junior now and I thought I just needed to come in and say hello." I said, "Okay, who's your brother?" She said, "Aaron." Aaron. "Oh, Aaron." "Now I know why you've come in to say hello. So let me tell you about Aaron. 5 years before she came in, I was sitting at my desk between third and fourth period, sometime along in there, and I heard a little noise out in the hallway outside the door, and there was Aaron, 6 feet, 3 inches tall. He'd been hitting the weights. He was about 250 or 260, black guy. And right up against him was another guy named Tim. I'd had Aaron in class the year before. I'd had Tim in homeroom, so I knew them both. That was very good. And Tim was about 6'1 and 200 pounds and was known to just love to fight. And Tim had his little skinny white nose right up against Aaron's broader, flatter nose, and they were touching. And I said, "We have a problem here." So I went as fast as I could, and their attention was totally focused on each other. So I needed to get their attention. So I put my 6 foot 3 inch nose right against their two noses and made a triangle, hoping that my timing was good. And then when I had their attention, I said to Aaron, "Aaron, take one step back. Tim, take one step back." It was early May. They were both going to graduate in about 3 weeks. And then I stepped between them. And I said, "All right, Aaron, you walk that way and get to class. Tim, you walk that way and get to class." And good for me, I didn't happen to be there right when somebody started swinging, because Tim had been saying what are called fighting words, trying to get Aaron to swing first and then have a brawl. So I said to the sister, "So why'd your brother say to come see me?" She said, "Oh, you're famous in our family." Because if there'd been a fight, neither one would have walked to graduation. That was our school policy. And this way they could. Now, all parents have done that if you've got more than one kid. You've had children fighting, and you go in and you separate them. You are a peacemaker. That's one of the jobs of parents. Teachers do this all the time from grade K to grade 12. I don't think the wider society appreciates how much peacemaking teachers engage in between one student and another student. The sort of the public version of teacher problems is children disagreeing and being difficult for the teacher. But in a lot of places, that's problem number two. Problem number one is keeping this student from fighting with this student. So teachers do a lot of peacemaking. Well, here's my third idea as I'm thinking through. So who are peacemakers? And I thought, well, let's extrapolate. The police, of course, do the same thing as teachers, who do the same thing as parents an awful lot. How many police calls are domestic disputes? A lot of them. And they're brought in there, and they're supposed to somehow keep husband and wife from just going at it. Civil government. Isn't that the purpose of civil government? Look at the example of David. David is anointed king over Israel by Samuel. He is Saul's deputy, greatest commander. And then Saul gets jealous and David has to flee for his life. And then eventually Saul dies in battle with the Philistines. David knows his time has come and he has a significant political challenge before him. And that is how to unite all 12 tribes without warfare. Can you do it? Well, one is you've got a lot of people still loyal to the house of Saul who've been suspicious of David and who are not ready to just fall in line behind David. You ought to read through 2 Samuel, the first 8 chapters sometime, and just look at it from the point of view of statecraft aiming at making peace. When word comes to David from an Amalekite that Saul was dead and the Amalekite claims to have actually killed Saul, David executes the Amalekite just like that. And then he teaches all his followers a lament that is moving to anybody who reads it even today for Saul and his son Jonathan, and makes his men sing this lament for this enemy who's been trying to kill him. Why? Well, partly he wants peace in Israel. And then he goes to Judah and he's anointed king over Judah, but only one tribe out of the 12. And he sends a friendly message to the headquarters of the remnants of Saul's army that are being pulled together by his great general Abner. And the message basically says, the men of Judah have elected me, or have chosen me as king, and I have taken office. Basically, he's inviting them to join along. Abner says, nope, we're going to fight for the house of Saul, and a civil war begins. But when Abner finally has a falling out, and I won't go into the details, with the weak man who is the heir of Saul, and Abner's ready to make peace, he comes down and meets with David, and David says, we'll make peace. I just have one condition. I want my wife, who's the daughter of Saul, back. What better way dynastically for there to be peace long term than for David and Michael to have a son together who would be the next king? Now, in the end, she has no children. That doesn't happen. Joab comes back. That's David's general. Finds out that Abner has come down for a visit. David has told Abner, you'll be my general. Let's bring the parties together. Joab murders Abner. But in the end, the house of Saul has to admit defeat. Abner is now dead. They have nobody to lead them, really. And then David, having done all he could, does one more thing. When he hears that Joab, his general, has murdered Abner, the leader of the house of Saul, he refuses to eat for the rest of the day. He makes it as plain as he possibly can to everybody, I was not behind that. Joab did not act on my orders. He composes another lament and makes his men learn it and sing it for Abner. He's aiming at peace. And if you're the king, you need to know what used to be called statecraft, how to rule in a way that will not lead to civil war, how to lead in a way that will produce peace. And then, of course, David faces, now that he's united the kingdom, Philistia sees, a problem. All those warring tribes are now united, so Philistia engages and invades. David defeats them. Philistia invades again. David defeats them. Edom gets uppity. David defeats Edom. He defeats Moab. Ammon starts a war. He defeats Ammon. Syria gets involved. He defeats Syria. And they're all wars of defense. And by the time he's done, he has a big empire that he didn't set out to get. And he could have gone on and said, blessed is the conqueror, for he will be called a god. But he stops. And he leaves Phoenicia alone. Hiram, king of Tyre, was wise and decided to always stay at peace with David. And so Phoenicia remains untouched. not added to the empire, because he was not out for conquest. Although he fought a great deal, he was not out for conquest. So he ends the civil war, he defeats the invaders, he secures the borders, and he brings peace to Israel. We Americans can barely grasp what it meant for the Israelites to have a person like King David defeat their enemies and secure the borders and stop the regular border and tribal warfare and incursions. We have, even to this day, still inherited some of Jean-Jacques Rousseau's nonsense about the noble savage, written in complete ignorance in France in the late 18th century. The reality is, as loads and loads of studies and anthropologists have said, is that tribal life is often and generally one of constant warfare, constant strife, constant danger. This is why in many tribes, children quickly learn the uncle is just as important as the father, because the odds are good that the father will be dead before the child gets to any age, and the uncle will be the man who looks out for him and raises him. I read an interesting article in the New Yorker not too long ago, sort of summarizing all this research and concluding that you were less likely to be killed if you lived in Poland from 1939 to 1945 than if you just lived in any ordinary tribe in New Guinea before the Christians got there. That was tribal life. In Israel and between Israel and Edom and Israel and Ammon and Israel and the Midianites and Israel and the Amalekites, it was constant danger. And David and Saul before him, they bring unity and with it peace. We are told, as plainly as we could be in the scriptures, pray for kings and all in authority, and what's the reason? That we may lead peaceable and quiet lives. Presidents, dictators, kings, whoever, they can plunge a whole country into warfare for years if they are unwise, if they are aggressive, if they are foolish. And when a country is fully engaged in war, and it's on your soil, nobody escapes. And we see what we mean by peace. When Jesus was born, there's my fourth idea, peacemakers. When Jesus was born, what was it that the angels sang? Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace among those with whom he is pleased. We see Jesus with his disciples playing the part of elders in a church. Remember the disciples at one point, they get into argument which one's the greatest. All right, Peter says, I'm the greatest. John says, actually, I'm the greatest. Another time, James and John come to Jesus and they say, look, when you get your kingdom established, can I be Secretary of State and he'll be Secretary of Defense? And the other disciples are angry at them. And each time, Jesus calls them all together and reteaches them again that they're not to be like that. But the Gospels begin not with that kind of peacemaking, but with David's kind of peacemaking. What's the point of the temptation stories in Matthew and Luke? Isn't it just this, that Jesus defeats our enemy and his enemy? Tempted and Satan loses. Tempted and Satan loses. Tempted and Satan loses. Mark's gospel begins exactly the same way. After the baptism of Jesus, the very first miracle we have is Jesus in a synagogue. And somebody who's demon-possessed stands up and interrupts the church service. And Jesus says to the demon, come out of the man, leave him alone. And the demon must obey. And then the next thing we see is Jesus healing Peter's mother-in-law. And you know, sickness eventually ends up in death. Sooner or later, you get sick and you don't recover and you die. And that's our second great enemy, Satan, and then death. And then the next picture we have is Jesus doing the unthinkable for a Jew. He puts his hand on a leper. And instead of the leper making Jesus unclean because Jesus touched him, which is how it ordinarily would work, Jesus' hand makes the leper clean. And that uncleanness was intended by God from the beginning, all those ritual rules, to teach us what sin does for us in the presence of God. It makes us unclean, unfit for his sight. And where Jesus goes and touches the sin and the uncleanliness, he makes us clean and guiltless. So Jesus is like King David. He makes peace by defeating our enemies. It sounds, you see, almost contradictory to Americans these days. He makes peace by defeating our enemies. He defeats Satan, he defeats sin, and he defeats death. His contemporaries wanted him to defeat Rome, but he was after deeper enemies than Rome. And now there's a fifth category. We read about it in Isaiah. But let me go first to Ephesians chapter 6. It's an often studied passage. Ephesians chapter 6, verse 14. And I'm going to read 14 and 15. Listen. Stand therefore, having fastened on the belt of truth, and having put on the breastplate of righteousness, and as shoes for your feet, having put on the readiness given by the gospel of peace. As shoes for your feet, having put on the readiness given by the gospel of peace. We read the passage from Isaiah 52. Blessed are the feet of those on the mountains that bring good news. In the Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament, it's the word that we translate gospel. So blessed are those of the feet who bring on the mountains the good news of peace. Now, do you know what that meant if you lived in Jerusalem? Jerusalem was up in the mountains. And if there was an invading army, and the king had his own army and things in good order, he didn't wait for the army to get to the walls of Jerusalem, not unless it was overwhelming. You sent your army out, and you would watch the army leave the city, gather its strength as it went through the countryside, and if you were in Jerusalem, you waited. You waited for news. Would our men be victorious against this invading enemy? Or would they come back running and fleeing for their lives and hide in the city and we wait for a siege to begin? That's the ancient world. It happened often in Constantinople. It happened in Rome. It happened in many cities. It happens famously in Athens. There's an invasion by the Persians. A great battle at a location called Marathon. And everybody in Athens waits behind the walls. Will there be one runner coming or will there be a disordered group of retreating soldiers coming? And Pheidippides runs with the news. We won. There will be peace. You will be safe. The enemy is defeated. Now, that verse is quoted in Romans chapter 10, verse 15. How then will they call on him in whom they have not believed? And how are they to believe in him of whom they have never heard? And how are they to hear without someone preaching? And how are they to preach unless they are sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who preach the good news, right from Isaiah. How beautiful are the feet of those who preach the good news. And Jesus says as his last words to his disciples, you're to go to all the nations You're to preach. The enemy is defeated. Satan's power is broken. Death is defeated. I've risen from the dead, and so will you. I'm the first fruits. Sin is defeated. You can be reconciled with God in Jesus Christ. It's good news. And every place the preachers go, they take basically that message. One of my most memorable moments in the synod of our church comes now about 7 or 8 years ago with a video of villagers in the South Sudan who have believed in Jesus Christ, and they are taking their idols in the middle of the village and they are burning the idols and they're dancing around them. Those idols that have oppressed us, that have demanded from us, that have made our lives miserable, in fact, that have done nothing for us. They're gone. They're defeated. Jesus has defeated, and now we have real life, real peace, and real salvation. It reminded me, of course, of what you read about in the book of Acts in Ephesians. When Paul was in Ephesus, they brought their magic books together, and they burnt them there in the middle of the city. How beautiful are the feet of those who bring the gospel of peace to one place after another throughout the world. Well, those are the five ideas I had of who are the peacemakers. The peacemakers are people who settle quarrels. The peacemakers are those who exercise, I would say, police action in stopping fights. Peacemakers are the civil government. That's their task. Peacemakers are above all fulfilled in Jesus Christ, who makes peace because he defeats our deepest and most lasting enemies. And peacemakers are preachers of the gospel, especially those who take that message to new and distant places. And why do they do that? How is it that the church comes up with so many able people, generation after generation after generation, to lead their homes and their families? It's because Jesus takes them captive and says, go. And off they go. That's what he says in Ephesians. They'll be called sons of God. We have another translation problem. The old King James actually uses the word children. And here's the trouble. The Greek word is unmistakably sons. And yet also, the usage of that word sons, most of the time, actually includes everybody. Right? It's a generic noun, and so it's men and women. So you might say, blessed are the peacemakers, men and women both, for they shall be called the sons of God. Well, why not translate children the way the old King James Bible did? Well, it's because sons of God have all these echoes through the scripture. Let me just quickly run through them. Genesis 6:2, the sons of God saw the daughters of men. You may remember the passage. And the sons of God there are those who are descended from a faithful and godly line through Seth. Exodus 4:22, through Moses, God says to Pharaoh, Israel is my firstborn son. You might almost hear God saying to Pharaoh, do you understand what that means? I'm going to fight for him. You're to let him go. You're not to hold him as a slave any longer. Israel is my firstborn son. Hosea picks that up, chapter 11, verse 1. I called my son out of Egypt. And of course, it's Israel that Hosea has in mind. And yet, when you get to Matthew 2:15, and Matthew's telling the story of Jesus' parents coming back from Egypt to settle in Nazareth after Herod had died, he says, and as it was foretold, I will call my son out of Egypt. And the point Matthew is making is that Jesus fulfills in himself all that God ever intended for Israel. Israel was to be a light to the nations. Jesus is the real light to the nations. Israel is God's son. Jesus is God's son. God said to David, about his son. I will be a father to him, and he shall be my son. You can find that in 1 Chronicles and 2 Samuel. Psalm 2, verse 7. My son. I've established my son. He will sit on the throne. He will reign. And the nations and the elites may yell against him, but there he will stay. Luke 3:38, the genealogy that Luke includes, different in a few places from Matthew's. The way it ends has always startled me. You can look it up. The very last words are, the son of Adam, comma, the son of God. And this is carried forward into the New Testament. Jesus is the Son of God. And then astonishingly in Hebrews, the writer says of Jesus that he's not ashamed to call us, do you remember what it is? His brothers, his brethren. He is not ashamed to call us his brethren. We are counted as sons of God. Men and women, we are sons of God because Jesus is ready to say, that's my brother. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the sons of God. Now, why are peacemakers called the sons of God? Well, we have an old expression in English, like father, like son. And it's actually God's work in history to re-establish the peace broken in the beginning in the garden by our first parents. Peace with God, peace among men, peace in our hearts, peace with the creation. And Jesus has brought peace, and he, the Son of God, is not ashamed to call us brothers. That's why the New Testament, the Christians often just called each other brothers. Actually, for a while, when I was teaching courses at the Center for Urban Theological Studies in Philadelphia, I would occasionally get phone calls, and one day my wife got a phone call. Somebody called up, Baptist persuasion, you'll be able to pick this up quickly. Hi, is Brother Bill there? Gretchen said, who? Brother Bill. Pardon me? I said, is Brother Bill there? And she said, oh, yes, you mean my husband. I'll get the phone for him. Yes. If peacemakers live a full life, a completed life, and therefore blessed and happy, what shall we say about peacebreakers? I'm only going to just mention one thing. It'd be worth a whole other sermon. I'll just mention one thing. The New Testament says to a church, when you come to elect elders, do not choose peacebreakers. Do not choose quarrelsome people. Do not choose contentious people. It doesn't matter how much money they have. It doesn't matter how much learning they have. It doesn't matter how many connections they have. It doesn't matter how many generations they've been in the church. Do not choose peacebreakers. They do not belong in the position of elder or deacon in the church. You can look that up in Titus chapter 1. In 2 Corinthians, Paul goes through a whole list of terms that amount to peacebreakers, and he's saying to the church there in Corinth, you are not to be like this. 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 20. For I fear that perhaps when I come, I may find you not as I wish, and that you may find me not as you wish. That perhaps there may be, now listening to how many of these things deal with peacebreaking. Perhaps there may be quarreling, jealousy, anger, hostility, slander, gossip, conceit, and disorder. What a shame for a church to ever have that kind of description of it. Now, if Christians are peacemakers, does that mean Christians will always enjoy peace? That's why these last Beatitudes are so important. They protect us from that kind of contemporary American attitude. If we would just be reasonable, everybody else would just be reasonable. And it's not so, because there's real evil abroad in the world. And real evil abroad in the world sometimes does not just respond to reasonableness and peacemaking and kindness and goodness. What it sees is weakness and opportunity. So that's why Paul writes to the church in Rome, "In as much as lies in you, be at peace with all men." Note the conditional. In as much as it lies in you, be at peace with all men. Peter writes in his first letter, "If you're going to suffer, don't suffer for being a thief or for being a murderer. Make sure you suffer as a Christian." But notice the expectation, you may well suffer as a Christian. And Jesus does not put a break in the Beatitudes between verse 9 and 10. We'd like to put 9, 10, and 11, and 12, or 10, 11, and 12 off in a different category, but that's exegetical nonsense. He goes right on. "Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake." It's all out in the open now. It's not just a spiritual thing. "For theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account." Let me tell you, nobody feels happy and fulfilled in that situation. "Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you." The Bible has no place for the great American game of make-believe and let's pretend. There are enemies of Jesus Christ abroad in the world. And what is called in our country organized religion is what they fear and what they attack. If you want to just go be by yourself and read your Bible and pray, the unbelieving world is going to pretty much not care. But if you're part of organized religion, which means what? Us, the church, then they know there's a threat here. And it's a real threat, because there's a real warfare. And those last three verses don't allow us to hide and not face the reality. I heard a presentation over at Geneva College a couple of weeks ago, which began with an opinion survey of non-Christians concerning evangelicals. How many think it was positive? How many think it was negative? Oh, was it? And unfortunately, we were given to understand that this meant there was some failing in the evangelical church. We weren't good enough at our PR. Or we weren't being winsome enough. I'm tired of that cliche, by the way. We weren't being winsome enough. Or we weren't being positive enough. And on and on. Now, all those things may be true. We're not called to be unnecessarily offensive. But as I listened to all of those 10 items, I said to myself, guilty, and I should be. Guilty, and I should be saying that. Guilty, and the church should be saying this. And of course, the unbelieving world will not like it and will say critical things and nasty things about those who say them. And because of my position, I did not do what comes naturally to me, which was engage in debate with the speaker. But I thought to myself, what would he say about how dreadfully the church of the Roman Empire had failed in the year 200? Do you know what their reputation was? Their reputation was that they were atheists, because they had no idols to worship, so they were atheists, you couldn't see their gods. Their reputation was they were cannibals, a somewhat garbled version of the Lord's Supper. And their reputation was that they were haters of everybody because they wouldn't go to the gladiator fights and to the exceedingly lewd circuses. Jesus says, a servant is not above his master. If they have spoken ill of me, they will speak ill of you. And the Christian church in this country had better get used to the reality of the Beatitudes verses 10, 11, and 12, and not pretend that if they happen, it's our fault. We may contribute, we have our faults, but it's going to be there whether we are perfect or imperfect. It may be the better we are, the more likely we are to kind of bring this down upon our heads. There's real evil abroad in the world. And therefore, Jesus says, blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. Well, I'm getting ahead into the next sermons in this series, but let me go back to the Beatitude for today. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. That's our calling. That's who God intends us to be. And what a high, high blessing to be called the sons of God. Inasmuch as lies in you, be at peace with all men.